Hi, this is Tamsin Granger.
This is Dan Abuhoff.
With Tamsin and Dan Read the Paper. It's
November
26th.
That's right.
Sunday.
Right.
2017. We're in kind of the hangover state from Thanksgiving.
Figuratively, not literally.
Yeah. Just full of food, full of fun.
And we had a nice Thanksgiving.
Full of yoga.
Yes.
And we had family together.
Right.
And we ate a lot.
Right. But forget the food. It was a wonderful family Thanksgiving. And it was great. But we have a chock full show, as they like to say, because it's a holiday show and we're stuck between Black Friday and Cyber Monday. So we know we have to offer value. And value is what you're going to get.
So this is Podcast Sunday.
Podcast Sunday.
Because there was Small Business Saturday.
Small Business Saturday.
So it must be Podcast Sunday.
Or Smaller Business, even Smaller Business Sunday. So, you know, when Thanksgiving, you think of the parade, and I think there's something that we ought to bring to people's attention.
We haven't been to the parade in years.
Oh, we haven't.
We do watch it.
We haven't been to the parade.
It's always on in the background.
Look, I don't think
preparations are going on.
People don't understand. People out of town don't understand the television parade and the real parade are two entirely different things. Because the television parade is somewhat dominated by performances that take place at Herald Square. But the regular parade, people aren't standing in Herald Square. They're not seeing those performances. They're there for the balloons.
Yeah.
More than anything.
Yeah.
That's the parade. What we saw an article about mishaps and milestones, how the Macy's parade balloons have fared that appeared this Thursday. And there's been some up and down. We'll just make one point about this, which kind of shocked me. The first Macy's parade, it was in 1924, and they had balloons soon enough, but the tradition was that at the end of the parade, they released the balloons up into the air.
Into the stratosphere?
Into the stratosphere.
Just let them go?
And it, yes.
Or
and
were they just literally just little balloons?
No, they were big balloons, and they were filled with helium. And, you know, someone ended up in Long Island, someone ended up in the East River, someone ended up in the Atlantic Ocean, and they would give prizes for people who found the balloons the farthest away from Herald Square. And this was
Must have been an amazing sight to see, like, Mickey flying over.
Exactly.
The metropolis.
They thought this was a great idea until 1932. In 1932, if you can believe it, a 60-foot Tomcat balloon floated up into the air and collided with an airplane. With a small airplane where a woman was taking flying instructions, okay? And the Times reported this story that from her perspective, the Tomcat floated into the view like a sea serpent out of its native element.
That must have been such a nightmare.
The left wing of the plane smacked against the balloon fabric that was Tom's hide, and the plane plummeted. They were headed for a crash landing, and the instructor took over and manages to pull the airplane out of a dive and to save them. And that's when they stopped releasing the balloons.
I think that makes some sense.
It does. So it's not like Macy's doesn't learn. So, there you go. So we've had a great weekend and a great week. And it started, as you know, from last week. As loyal listeners know, we saw Brigadoon last Sunday night.
A production of Brigadoon at City Center.
That's right.
Part of the Encores.
That's right.
With Kelly O'Hara.
Right.
Patrick Wilson. Stephanie J. Block.
And Robert Fairchild, who was the main dancer. And that's no small thing because Brigadoon is a substantial musical, we had a great time. We thought it was great. And it's not just music, it's not just singing, it's a dancing. And Robert Fairchild.
A lot of dancing.
Late of American in Paris.
Many ballet.
Was fantastic.
Interludes.
Yes, which might have tested the patience of a modern theater goer, but that's not us.
I don't know if that's the case, because Granger and Nico went with us.
Yeah.
And they actually enjoyed the dance.
Did they?
They said a great deal, perhaps more than the music. The musical is 70 years old.
Right.
So it's really kind of old school.
It is school. It is old fashioned. And, you know, when you tell people, first of all, people always call Brigadoon second tier. They say it's not Rodgers.
We went through this last week.
Right. Okay, fine. But look, it was old fashioned, but it was still wonderful. And the reviews were on and on about Kelly O'Hara, who's in the main part, the woman who falls in love with the guy who's from the real world. She's a denizen of Brigadoon. And in my mind, I mean, she was great, but in my mind, it's a unique opportunity for someone like Kelly O'Hara, because the other
A denizen. This is a love story.
She lived in Brigadoon. So
this guy from New York.
She's a denizen.
And falls in love with a denizen.
I'm trying to spice up the cast here, but the point is, when she's doing these other shows, when she's doing South Pacific, when she's doing King and I, the main singing parts aren't the women singing parts. I don't know if anyone's really focused on this. They're the male singing parts. And the reason is because the leading ladies in those shows were not singers. Okay? It was Gertrude Lawrence and it was Mary Martin. They weren't really looking to sing. Kelly O'Hara in Brigadoon, she's got the parts. She's doing the singing and she is wonderful and fantastic voice. And the other thing that Brigadoon has going for it is, you know, Lerner and Lowe come through. I mean, it's I think it's wonderful music and wonderful lyrics. You know, it's funny. The key song is almost like being in love. And
well, for you, it is.
For me, it is. For me, it is. For me and everybody else, but perhaps not you. What's the key song for you?
You're putting me on the spot.
Okay.
But there are
the most popular song. Is Almost Like Being in Love?
I have no idea. Okay. I have not done a Google search.
Here's my point.
You know what? Surprisingly, I don't want to step on your point, but one of the songs I like is, I like the tenor bits.
Right, okay.
You know,
okay.
Back in the day, there was always, you know.
There's a male tenor who sings the song Bonnie Jean.
Yeah, Come Home to Bonnie Jean.
Come Home to Bonnie Jean. And it's a Scottish Highlands piece.
I don't always go for a tenor, but.
Well, look, Almost Like Being in Love. Here's my point about Almost Being in Love. It's not important to decide which is the best song. The point is that there are great songs in it. There are several standards in it. And Almost Like Being in Love is, as you can tell from the title, is right in the tradition of the way they used to write love songs then. You couldn't say, you often didn't say, so-and-so, you know, Jack loves Jill, Mary loves so-and-so. It had to be some kind of deflection. So what you have is you have Richard Rodgers writing People Will Say We're in Love, right? As opposed to Being in Love. Or If I Loved You in Carousel.
Yeah, but that's not because people didn't do that.
That's because
you got to have a lot of songs in this musical.
Right.
You got to lead up to
creep
it.
Up to
you
it.
Can't have all your songs being, I love you, I love you, I love
I
you.
I understand.
And by the way, I love you.
Okay.
You know?
But Almost in Being in Love is like that. The guy's singing this song with almost a jaunty rhythm to it. The male lead, he's by himself and he's singing, what a rare mood I'm in, while it's almost like being in love, doing a little bit of a dance. And then the woman happens by and overhears him, and then she sort of joins in and sings a lyric herself. All the music of life seems to be like a bell that is ringing for me. And then it ups the ante, and they're both great singers. And then they face each other and they say, and from the way that I feel when the bell starts to peal, I would swear I was falling. I could swear I was falling. It's almost like being in love. And it brings down the house. You'll agree with me there.
Yeah.
It's a wonderful musical. We also saw a movie.
Right.
We saw Lady Bird.
Right.
And
written and directed by Greta Gerwig.
That's right.
Starring Saoirse Ronan,
right,
and Laurie Metcalf as
right.
the young woman's mother, Tracy Letts as the dad, and
what do you think?
I enjoyed it. It's a coming of age film,
mm-hmm.
and it really sort of captures the relationship between mother and daughter. Just as the daughter is about to graduate from high school, mm-hmm. go on to college, it has that tension of. You know, you're going to lose the daughter.
Right.
And how as the mother do you deal with this? And it seemed very realistic. But, it's been highly praised. It's having tremendous success. I guess I was expecting more. I don't know what I was expecting. But I have to say that we went with the whole family.
Yeah.
And the younger people, I think, were more captured by it than we were.
They were.
And that was interesting.
They were. It was easier for them to identify with the main character.
In fact, somebody in the group said, this is the story of my life.
I don't get that exactly, but close enough. But they graduated, this is when Granger graduated about the same time.
Yeah. So a lot of it resonated chronologically.
It's very timely, and it's very easy to identify the character. But I had the same reaction of you, and I don't know whose fault that is. It's no one's fault. But the reviews were over the top. This is a great movie. It's not a great movie, but it's a very good movie, and it's interesting, and it was a good choice for Thanksgiving because, as you say, everyone was interested in it, and it spurred a lot of very interesting discussion.
Mm-hmm.
I thought about the way the mother and the daughter dealt with the daughter's coming of age and eventually leaving the nest.
Right.
So recommend it. Yeah. Recommend it.
And, you know, and the young girl, and, well, we won't say. Maybe somebody's going to see it.
Yes, don't all get right. too much of it. But Saoirse Ronan is always very good.
Yes.
And so you had Museum Yoga.
Yeah, Museum Update this week is about... Like, once again, about you know, getting exercise in the museum. Well, not really.
Once again.
Well, we mentioned, I don't know if you listen to the podcast all the time, but there was kind of a
walking
a dance exercise program in the Met.
I was there. Okay, I remember. Right.
And so there's another little article about meditation at the Asia Society.
Really?
Also at the Rubin Museum, they have a variety of programs, including meditation, but also something called a sound bath, which explores a vibrational healing process with singing bowls. Singing bowls are pretty cool. You know, you rub them around and then make that wonderful sound. And also something called ear yoga, which hones your hearing by stretching underused auditory muscles.
Wow.
Asking participants to think with their ears. Anyway, the Rubin Museum, it's basically Asian art, and it's on West 17th Street. Great museum, fun place to go. So that sounds interesting. But the most compelling offering seems to be at the National Jazz Museum in Harlem. Okay, that has a vinyasa flow with live jazz. 90-minute yoga class.
Wow.
Starts out with casual meet and greet, followed by an hour of yoga, which is accompanied by live hip-hop infused jazz.
They do this regularly? This is like a regular thing?
Let me see. It second Saturday of the month from 3:30 to 5.
Wow.
$10.
We belong to the wrong gym.
So that would be fun to go to, the National Jazz Museum in Harlem, West 129th Street.
That's unbelievable.
So these are intriguing ways to utilize museums.
We're going to yin yoga. They say no talking, nothing. Silence.
Well, I love yin yoga. Yin yoga,
I'm not criticizing yin yoga.
Changed my life.
But there's no jazz band.
A different approach. Also, in terms of updating items of various levels of interest. There was an estate sale at Grey Gardens. Mm-hmm. So you remember this is the house owned by Sally Quinn and had been the estate of...
The Beale sisters.
Yes, the Edie. And mother and daughter.
Right.
Anyway, so the property's being sold, but all the contents were being sold, or a great deal of the contents. And there was a huge crowd.
Yeah.
But they were all fans of Edie.
Yeah, it's the Bouvier family and the Jackie Kennedy's family.
Right.
And, going way back, right.
So there were people... Apparently, there were some items from Big and Little Edie.
Really?
Yeah, actual items from there. So people... I don't know if these are things just left behind by them when Quinn and Ben Bradley bought the house.
I think that there's a cult following because you had the documentary about them, and then you had the musical.
Yeah, but it's just odd that there were still things left behind by them to buy. And that's what people wanted. They also bought things that had been owned by Ben Bradley and Sally Quinn, which, you know, are more famous to me.
Yeah.
Personally. Well, and of course, Ben Bradley is going to be a hot topic.
Because he's going to be portrayed by Tom Hanks in the new movie about the Washington Post and the Pentagon Papers.
Right.
So he'll be back in the news. But when you read the article, you get the impression that the so-called super fans are fans of Edie Beal, the Bouvier family.
Yeah.
And they would not be deterred. They were coming here to buy any stick that belonged to them.
Yeah.
So there you go. So here's something that I thought was really interesting, because I was, you know, like many people, turned my nose up at this, and now I am turning my nose back down. It's an article called "E-Bikes Aren't Here to Replace Your Bicycle, But Your Car."
Well, that was pointed out to us by our son Zeke.
Yeah, but, you know, I don't take Zeke that seriously.
But here's the thing, we thought e-bikes were for cheaters.
Right.
I remember years and years and years ago, we were on a hiking tour.
Right.
And somebody on the tour from Florida said, gee, I wish I had one of those bikes with a motor.
Right.
She said she liked to go on these bike tours with the big clubs, but they do like 90 miles in a day, and she wasn't quite prepared. So from then on, we pretty much thought of, you know, e-bikes as a way to cheat, as a way to keep up.
Right.
If you can't ride a bike under your own steam.
Right.
But Zeke and Noel recently, a year ago, moved to California, and they've been reluctant to invest in a car. And one of the ways they're able to get around and commute to their jobs was by spending a lot less than one would on a car, even a used car, and getting
Well, that's exactly what this article is about. They say that people talk about electrical cars. Only 1% of all vehicle sales, about 1 million electrical cars, are going to be sold this year. Compare that with 35 million e-bikes.
Really?
35
in the U.S. or all in the world?
35 million e-bikes. And if anything, they're more popular in Europe. But here's the change in e-bikes that I wasn't onto. Maybe you, Tamsin, were onto this. The original e-bikes were what's called throttle e-bikes. In other words, they would move as if they had a motor, and you somehow would coordinate the pedaling with that. The newer e-bikes, or at least some of them are, called pedal assist e-bikes. They don't go anywhere if you don't pedal.
Yeah.
And you can also very accurately determine by operating, by moving your handlebars, exactly how much assistance that you want. In other words, they've advanced.
Mm-hmm.
And the assist is not on the back tire.
Mm-hmm.
It's all in the middle of the bicycle, so you have a better center of gravity.
Mm-hmm.
All right? This changes the game, as far as I'm concerned.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people are very down on throttle e-bikes. That was cheating, as you were talking
about.
Okay,
so that was like a mini motorcycle.
Yeah. And as a matter of fact, it comes into the law in New York because they're clamping down on throttle e-bikes. But even de Blasio, the mayor, has said, but we're okay with the pedal e-bikes. Because the throttle e-bikes can go 20 miles an hour with no one doing anything.
Well, the pedal e-bikes is what they had on the bike trips we've been
is
on.
Is that right?
Yes.
Okay. Well,
because I heard one of the people using one describe it.
Look, these are only going to get better and only get, as they say, more and more like a regular bicycle ride. And, of course, you're talking about a cost, you know, around $1,000, you know, at most, most $2,000. And as opposed to the cost of an electric car, it's a real alternative.
Yeah.
So I was struck by this. I think this is only going to get better and better.
Yeah, it's not a real alternative for all kinds of travel.
But it's important.
Within range.
I think it's important.
It gives you a lot more access.
Yeah.
Okay.
Holiday food, dear.
Holiday food. Well, I did notice in the New York Times, at least in the electronic version of the New York Times, an article about the Thanksgiving foods Googled in every state.
Yeah.
And, the top searches around Thanksgiving by state. And it doesn't really tell you what people necessarily are cooking in that state. But it does tell you something. And there are some fun, unexpected searches going on. Okay? For instance, the top search in Nebraska, South Dakota, and Iowa was for something called Snicker salad, sometimes called Snicker apple salad, which is basically chopped up candy bars, Cool Whip, and maybe some apples.
I'm shocked that more than one person searched for that.
like 145 times as many people searched for that in those states as for other things across the country. West Virginia, not a big surprise. The top search is for deer jerky, a recipe for deer jerky.
Yeah.
They might have a lot of deer.
Yeah.
For dinner, available right. to turn into jerky, if it's anything like Pennsylvania.
There is a jerky store in New Hope, by the way.
Now. There is, yeah, but do they have deer jerky?
I'm sure, I hope they do.
Because maybe we could contribute. It's, we have an awful lot of deer.
Yeah.
In Maine, the top search is for pumpkin whoopie pie. So that sounds seasonal, okay. right?
We're getting almost human.
But how about Colorado, Idaho, Nevada, and Utah? The search is for something called frog eye salad.
Oh, yeah.
No. Here's what it is. It's this pasta. It's a little, little teeny balls, pasta in little teeny balls. And it's put together with fruit, eggs, whipped cream, and marshmallows. It's not really, some of these are not really salads. They're more like dessert salads. Okay. They're not meant to. And then Maryland, oddly enough, sauerkraut. And Georgia, key lime cake.
All right. Now you're right.
So there's a lot of fun fun to be had looking at those.
Yeah. All right. There was an interesting article in the Times about The Lion King. One would think there's not a lot to say about The Lion King. The Lion King has been around...
The musical.
It's been around for 20 years in New York, at least. And the estimate is that 90 million people have seen it in 24 productions. They've grossed close to $8 billion. But here's something that I didn't know. Almost every cast, and there are a lot of casts, have included 8 to 12 South Africans among the 50 performers. In other words, 20% South Africans. And the way that they audition and hire that portion of the cast is that each year the production company, including Julie Taymor, the original director of Lion King, goes to Johannesburg and auditions South African aspirants to be in one of these many productions of The Lion King. And that what the Time story is about is that that audition attracts people from all these neighboring villages. They're not attracting urban performers so much. There are people in neighboring villages who are extremely poor villages, some without electricity, some whatever. And this is identified as the chance to make some serious money, to get out of the area that they live in, to see the world, whatever. It's a huge opportunity. And there are even schools that have been developed in and around Johannesburg to help train people for the annual audition for The Lion King.
For these worldwide companies. Wow.
And Julie Taymor, again, herself, is there auditioning the people. Well, the Times article, it's a substantial article, and it talks about two or three situations, including a woman who's been auditioning for years and others who have auditioned and succeeded. And even those stories are varied. One woman... this means you're on the road away from your family. Sometimes the people who win the audition have children.
Do they say how long the stints are?
It's up to them to some degree, but it's often 3 or 4 years.
Really?
And in the case of one woman that they describe, she goes for 3 or 4 years. She makes some serious money. She comes back and she's succeeded in becoming a soap opera performer in South Africa. Another woman, 3 or 4 years, comes back, and they become very homesick. They want to come back. But there is no job for her. And she ends up back in her village. And she's hoping to audition again because she just runs out of money. There's no real career path for these folks, for many of these folks. And finally, they end with a woman who has auditioned several times and has always tried but failed to make the cut. And finally, she makes the cut. She's going to be in a production in the Netherlands, though she has to learn to speak Dutch, but she says she'll do that. And the family's extremely emotional. She got this great job. They say she plans to return to her village one more time before departing, where she expects a sheep or a chicken to be slaughtered for a family feast, thanking the ancestors and hoping for a safe journey. This month, she will fly to Manila for a costume fitting, then begin rehearsing. She expects to be in the show through 2020. And that's when the tourists do back in South Africa. So, you know.
Well, that's interesting. It's interesting they go to those lengths to have some sense of authenticity.
Julie Taymor says they need that ballast. They need that grounding. It's important to her.
But it's poignant that for some people, this is just an adventure.
Right. But it's an opportunity they can't
turn away. And doesn't lead turn away. Anywhere.
Yeah. Well, yeah. That's right. Yeah. That's exactly right. You had an article about the efficacy of taking notes. Learning.
Well, not about the efficacy of taking notes, but taking notes on a laptop.
Okay.
Which it turns out is not too effective. That the students' studies are being done that say the students who take notes on the laptop actually do poorly in the class.
Right.
Compared to students taking notes by hand.
Right.
Okay, it says those who use laptops had substantially worse understanding of the lecture as measured by a standardized test than those who did not. Researchers hypothesized that because students can type faster than they can write, they're really just transcribing the lecture and not absorbing it at all. And apparently when you write down some notes, you're having to absorb the information and summarize it, pracy it, whatever, and kind of explain it to yourself. And it also, you know, kind of inscribes it into your memory in a different way than just, you know, being like a stenographer. Is that true about stenographers? Like when you're in court, do those
they don't retain anything. They're not there to retain anything. They're there to transcribe.
So they're
very mechanical.
Yeah, but this is a similar sort of thing. But also what's interesting is they say that often students not taking notes, but who are near the laptop note takers also do more poorly.
Why?
It's not really clear. It's like secondhand smoke.
No.
But there's a real question about how that...
Well, look, I identify with this in an odd way, and here is a failing of mine. I have terrible handwriting.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, when I was in school, people didn't have laptops, and that opportunity wasn't available. So whenever I was taking notes in any class, I was taking it with the knowledge that I might not be able to read the notes.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it caused me to concentrate a lot more and to say, I'm writing something down, I better be able to read it, but I better not understand what's being said now because I'm probably not going to get too much of a description of what's going on in my notes.
Okay, so that is the next study that will be done. The people with the good handwriting, the people with the bad handwriting.
Right.
See who does better
no
on the test.
No laptop and bad handwriting.
This may have been my problem. Maybe my handwriting was just too darn good for me to get the kind of grades.
You don't have too many problems.
Anyway, another reason why you might advise students to put away those laptops.
Well, you want that as a teacher because God knows what they're doing with those laptops.
I always say, you know, are you shopping? Are you on Zappo? Because I could use a pair of booties, black, size 8.5.
I have told you, I have talked to a professor at Harvard Law School who said the laptops drive him crazy. And I said, you're dealing with Harvard Law students. He said, don't kid yourself. Those kids are not necessarily taking those from the lecture. I know it for a fact.
Well, it's interesting now that, and now I would think, I wouldn't feel bad about saying no. You know, you're not, even if you're taking notes, you're not getting much out of it.
Well,
so,
I think I actually think there's something to it.
Let's engage with each other.
Okay, Great Falls, Montana. Okay.
Never been.
Right.
But now do I need to go there?
You do. There are 60,000 people who live there. It's mostly conservative people, they say. It can be a soul-deadening place. Big box stores, chain restaurants. The primary employer is the Air Force Base, which services nuclear missile silos. The wind chill has been known to hit 40 below. But the Times says you can't hold life back. It always breaks through in odd ways. In this case, the Sip and Dip, a kish-tastic tiki bar hidden inside the O'Hare Motor Inn. It is a tiki bar with mermaids.
Is that kish?
Kish.
Kish?
Kish.
Kish. Kish.
Am I pronouncing it wrong?
I don't know.
Kish-tastic. It's not a word. It's not going to catch on.
It's not great for pronunciation.
Look, here's the real point. They need mermaids down there in Great Falls. I'm hiring, said Sandra Johnson, the Sip and Dip's mer manager. Do you know anybody? I'm desperate, but they've got to be comfortable in a bikini top and a tail.
So do you have to go down to that mermaid school that we discussed
in an earlier podcast?
Or do you not need as much training?
I think
training.
They're so desperate that they don't need it. But
without training.
Look, it's not without challenging. They asked. They interviewed one of the mermaids. And they said, look, the truth is, toward the end of a four-hour shift, your mind can start to wander. Stuff like, did I remember to turn the coffee pot off when I left the house? You know, and the woman, by the way, would not let her name be used. She says, I don't know how the corporate world, where I have a real job, would react, knowing I was moonlighting as a mermaid. So in order to...
But if your mind wanders, do you really... Does your performance as a mermaid lose that much?
I think performance is a strong word. I think they're mostly floating around. But in any event, they're
so
much
appreciated. Is there music? I mean...
Oh, I'll get to the music in a second, but I want you to know that this place did actually advertise at one point for mermen. They were going to have a ladies' night once a week. And that was picked up by the local media and the local politicians. So when they advertised for mermen, the governor... tweeted, dang, I'm overbooked. The senator, John Tester, shucks, I'm busy. The state's attorney general, quote, Speedo was at the dry cleaners. you know, it went on from there. So apparently it's a known enterprise. You mentioned the music. The music is provided by an organist who is 85 years old, Piano Pat. And they note that she had sometimes a little trouble reading the music through her bifocals, but the crowd will carry her along in a sing-along style whenever she misses a few
when
lines
she falters.
Of music. When she falters. And she plays the kind of music that you'd expect, but people love it. As they say in the Times, for reasons that should now be clear, the Sip and Dip has become a must-visit for fans of Americana run amok, the wacky places where the human spirit gushes to the surface in an unexpected geyser.
I smell field trip.
Great Falls. Yeah, absolutely.
So it just occurred to me, I forgot to mention an important Thanksgiving food.
What's that?
From Colorado.
What's that?
And that was it Colorado? It was funeral potatoes. Funeral potatoes.
Right.
And it's a popular casserole for group situations, like a funeral situation, or for big meals like Thanksgiving. And it includes potatoes, often frozen shredded hash browns, a stick of butter, cornflakes, sour cream, 2 cans of cream of chicken soup, okay, and 2 cups of grated cheddar cheese.
That's a little thick.
So and that's pretty much all the comfort food you could possibly want in one casserole.
That's a little rough.
Funeral potatoes.
All right, let's go look to the crabs. I know you have a crab story.
Yeah, well, yeah, my comfort food is crab.
All right,
but in Australia, on Christmas Island, once a year, there's kind of a crisis because the red crabs, millions of red crabs, emerge from the forest and travel to the ocean every year to spawn. And it gets difficult to drive because they're going across the road.
Really?
And they've come up with all kinds of solutions.
Right.
Little tunnels for the crabs to go under
the
street, bridges over so they can go over. But there's still a lot of crabs in the road. So one of the talents you need to, as a local, you need to acquire is dodging the crabs as you're driving down the street. Many people carry a shovel or a broom in their car so they can stop and sweep them aside.
Really?
And some people have also invented various things to put on the front of the wheels to kind of scoop the crabs out of the way.
Really?
So that they don't get injured.
Ah, okay.
It kind of pushes them out of the way.
Very nice.
Rather than the tires running right over them.
Mm-hmm.
So that's something to watch out for if you go to Christmas Island.
Where is Christmas Island again?
Australia. It is a remote Australian territory near Indonesia.
Hmm. Okay.
So
fair enough. And there was finally an article about Babar.
Well, there was an interview with the current author of Babar, Laurent de Brunhoff. Now, it was his father, Jean, who first started writing the Babar stories after World War I. He passed away in the 30s, and he wrote quite a few, at least seven of the books. And at this point, Laurent is 92. He's written another book with the help of his wife, Phyllis Rose.
But he's written almost 50 books, I think.
Yes, and he's written more than 50. He has published more than 50. His book that he says will be the final is A Trip to Paris, a guidebook to Paris with Babar.
Yes.
The interview is kind of silly.
Right.
Full of kind of weird, silly questions, you know, to, you know, poor Mr. Brunhoff about does he, you know, as he's writing now, does he try to bring into the story the way Paris is now, right, and the dangers, etc. And
Mr. Brunhoff has his hands full. He's 92 years old.
And the interviewer asks him, does he think he's too old to relate to children? And he responds with, I never really think of children when I do my books. Babar was my friend, and I invented stories with him, but not with kids in the corner of my mind. I write it for myself. So I thought that was an interesting perspective, mm-hmm, because it does really read that way, if you read the books.
Yes. It has an unhurried atmosphere. It has almost an adult-like temperament, even as the cartoons are in front of you.
Yeah, and not a cuteness or, you know. So I just thought I would, it brings to mind at this time of year, one of our favorite Babar books, which would be Babar and Father Christmas.
Yes, of course, we read to our kids.
Yes, and it starts out with Zephyr the monkey calls to his friends Arthur, Pom, Flora, and Alexander, children of Babar. Listen to this wonderful tale which I've just heard. It seems that in man's country, every year on the night before Christmas, a very kind old gentleman with a large white beard wearing a red suit with a pointed hood flies over the countryside. He carries with him great quantities of toys and gives them to the little children. They call him Father Christmas. Why shouldn't we write to him and ask him to come here too and see us in Elephant's Country? So, of course, what happens is they write and they don't hear back. Babar has to go to Europe to find Father Christmas. And he thinks he's found him at one point because he's in a hotel and some mice come to him and say, oh, we know where Father Christmas is. And it turns out to be a little figurine in the attic. Mm-hmm. But he finally does some research and finds out that from a professor that Father Christmas is somewhere in Bohemia or north of Bohemia. And he goes and he finds Father Christmas. He actually falls into, Father Christmas apparently lives underground.
Yeah.
And he falls underground. And he and his dog named Duck find Father Christmas. They get a tour of everything with the elves, etc. And so Babar puts his case in front of Father Christmas. Can't you please come to Elephant Country? And Father Christmas says, you know, I don't think I can. I barely finished my job last year for the children of men. And I'm very, very tired. So what does Babar do? He invites Father Christmas to Elephant Country. He says, but Father Christmas, you must take care of yourself. And why don't you come to our country and recuperate? And so he does. And then he leaves and he says, you know, I'm still a bit busy to handle Elephant Country, but I'm going to leave you this magic suit. And with that, Babar is able to fly all over and play the role of Father Christmas.
All right.
And Father Christmas does drop by later with a Christmas tree. So Anyway, it's kind of a magical story written by the father, Jean, right. And with a real charm to it.
Yeah. No, listen, those were favorite stories of the kids.
So we're looking forward to Christmas stories, right? our favorite Christmas stories and songs and decorations, right?
Right. Here we go.
Happy holidays.
Happy holidays. And thanks for Tamsin and Dan Read the Paper.